go ahead and reconvene. And we are currently at section F, opponents to the project. We had a caller, I believe it was Freda, had her hand up, and as promised, we will go back to public comment in opposition, 3 minutes, and Freda is up.
Can you hear me, Jeff?
Yes.
My name is Freda Walker. I live at 5415 South Kidder Loop, and I have about 4 points to share with you. In Exhibit A3 in the findings, I wondered why the staff rejected the 5D alternative project number 3I, and that relates to decreasing the number from 844 to 622. It might not have a significant impact on paper, but it certainly would for those of us that are neighbors. The Kidder Creek Orchard Camp has stated they were willing, you know, to decrease the number. I wonder why the county's not willing to decrease it in the application. My second point has to do with, I'd like to see the detailed data about how the Kidder Creek Orchard Camp increases the economic vitality of Scott Valley. Hiring some staff, not all the staff, comes from Scott Valley or from our county. They come from out of state even. So I'd like to see more detail on that. The third point has to do with the Scott Valley Area Plan has protected, you know, protected Scott Valley from large-scale development. And once this application is approved, can the Scott Valley Area Plan continue to have impact on big operations that will change the rural nature of the valley? And I just sometimes I wonder how that's really going to play out as we see other people that know that they can have large-scale growth or large-scale operations that are not really within the city areas that are identified in the Scott Valley Area Plan. And I don't really see that addressed very much. It just says, you know, that it's ag property and, you know, and so it complies. The fourth thing that I wonder about is I know that in the exhibit A1, the applicant, Kidder Creek Orchard, cannot sue the county. And I wondered, has the county identified the weaknesses in the process or in the application that will open the doors to other entities or folks suing the county? That's my statement. I would like to just see a decrease in the amount of people that are going to be up there. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other individuals online wishing to speak in opposition? Okay, I don't see any. Rachel?
Seeing none.
Okay. So that will bring us to back to other public comments, neither for or against. And Paul already addressed us with the noise addition. Glenn's not in here yet. Okay.
He'll be in a minute.
That's right. He's here in case we need him. Proponents, any desire to rebut? Any oppositional comments at this time?
I'd like to just make a comment about the...
Make sure you reintroduce yourself.
Sorry. Yes. Andy Workin, 2333 South Kidder Creek Road. I'd just like to just see if our Lauren Chilson, our traffic expert, if he could join us. He's online. And see if he could speak to some of the questions about the traffic and also about the local economic impact that Freda just brought up. We hired, I think it was 95 staff this last summer at Kidder Creek. 47 of those were locals from Siskiyou County. And so obviously there's a big impact in providing staff opportunities for locals, as well as those people that are coming in from out of town are obviously spending their money, and we're reinvesting in the local community as well through that. So if we could have an opportunity for Laura to speak, there were some comments that came up earlier about the traffic, to have him address those if he's ready. And then also just wanted to speak to the pond and just kind of reiterate the new pond and reiterate that that's a pass-through pond. We're not impounding water in that situation, and just wanted to make sure that that was clear as well.
So Lauren, did you have anything you wanted to add in terms of the traffic component and comments that have been made? Not seen an unmute, so if we have questions, we will direct them to Lauren. All right. We will close the public hearing and bring this to the commission. And I've got a long list of questions, but I will refrain to end, see if some of you have similar comments and questions. So who would like to go first?
No, I talked to Mr. Lloyd and I talked to Mr. Dean, but whoever makes the motion, I would like to have it reflect, reduce the occupancy from the 844 back to the 622. If that could be done in the motion or amendment to the motion, or somehow notify the Board of Supervisors, that is the, provided you concur, that is the wishes of the Commission to reduce that occupancy number.
I have that noted as a request from Commissioner Veal. Other questions? Commissioner Mellow?
Not at this time, sir.
Commissioner Hart, or do you want me to start with mine?
Let me find the document here that I did. Go ahead.
Okay, so while you're looking, I will start with the first document that I have items highlighted on. It actually goes to on this one right here. So this, my question, and I thought I asked it in August, but I didn't see it reflected in the staff report. In the draft initial study, NIGDEC, on, for reference, page 2.01. So in section 2.0 in the project information, where it is describing the ownership specifically for the zone change, the first two are under ownership of Kidder Creek Orchard Camps, Inc. The third parcel is identified as being owned by Andrew and Emily Orkin. And then the subsequent ownerships of APNs is back to Kidder Creek. Council, on a zone change / use permit, is this allowable to have multiple ownerships of parcels?
It's allowable. All the owners would have to agree to. It is allowable. I don't know if the application, I assume the application is signed by everybody.
Yeah, I just want to be sure because we have multiple ownerships.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that.
You're right though, they would have to be agreed to by all property owners for rezoning.
Okay, and so we do have documentation showing that all parties involved agree to the zone, to the use permit.
Yes.
Okay.
So who's the responsible party should somebody not adhere to something?
That's my second question.
if somebody does not endure something, well, normally it would be the underlying property owner on whatever property the violation is existing. If it's this individual and it's on their property, then they would be responsible, but otherwise it's not occurring on the property, it's going to go to the underlying property owner. That's the way it always is.
Okay. That answers my question. It's the property owner
right.
where said violation may be occurring.
Then have jeopardized the whole project.
Does that trigger flat?
I can see it. If there were individual use permits on each parcel or property.
But we have one use permit.
For the whole umbrella.
So if there's a violation on the, let's say on the Andrew and Emily Working parcel, violation occurs there, that impacts the entire use permit, not just that property, correct?
It could, yes. It could.
It could or it would?
Well, it depends. If it's a zoning, if it's a issue with zoning and they're doing something not related to the use permit, it would just be them. If it's something to do with the use permit, then theoretically it could end up revoking the use permit at the most extreme.
So what do you do out there at the shopping center if one of the individual violates the use permit? Does it jeopardize the whole?
No use permit. That's allowable use on that zoned land.
Well, if it isn't. I mean,
in reality, I assume the operator could be insured and be working this out with the private property owners.
Yeah, I guess what makes me question it, not that it's likely that it would happen, but potentially that parcel could be sold to another individual, hypothetically, outside of Kidder Creek. And so that new owner would be responsible for following the use permit. Or is this parcel listed here solely as part of the zone change?
Right.
So is it zone change incorporated, which, okay, that easier for me to digest. But if it's also part of the use permit,
I think that's why probably I recently answered the question in light of a zone change rather than the use permit. A zoning violation rather than the use permit violation. I'll allow planning to check on that. I can see they're looking at them now.
Haley?
Sorry, I was double checking the APN, and it's included in the use permit, and it's also included most importantly in the CEQA analysis as well, so that's why that APN is called out.
Are any of the new proposed development identified to be located on that parcel? Or is it simply listed here as a parcel involved due for staff housing?
I believe it is for the latter, but let me double check to see what facilities are on there.
Well, I'm scrolling to my next one.
No, back up here. I'm not comfortable with this at all.
Well, I'm letting her look up before.
Okay, so where I'm not comfortable, you guys just dealt with a project this morning. You've been dealing with for something almost 20 years to get it resolved, where you had a use permit on a piece of property, where the holder of the use permit didn't own the property. And I look at the amount of resources that the county had to spend dealing with this, which is truly a civil issue between those parties. In this regard, you gentlemen, please correct me here. We have three different owners, one use permit, and three zone changes, correct?
No, two owners.
Two owners.
Two.
So, I guess they have to be comfortable with going forward, looking at the liability so that the county isn't hung out spending financial resources to try and sort the mess out. If something goes haywire, or different owners or whatever, because that can happen. Because once we grant a use permit, that's there forever unless they come in and get rid of it or the county has to take it back.
Correct. So Haley's still looking at that one for clarification. Mr. Hart, did you have another question while I'm scrolling to my next question?
No. I'm just uncomfortable with that situation. That's all. Personally, that's irrelevant to what these gentlemen want.
Okay, my next question for clarification, recognizing Commissioner Veal's proposal for a reduction in occupancy, there was a discrepancy in these documents. I just noticed two nights ago, reading through this compilation of data and information for the second time, in one of the project summaries, it was noted as 900 potential total occupancy, not the 844 maximum. And I'm guessing that was a typo?
Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
Because everywhere else I've seen a maximum of 844. So that being said, then going back to, let's see, is this, nope, this one. While we're dealing, I guess my scrolling is on occupancy. Can Andy or Mr. Lloyd or staff please clarify for me? I see in the table 3.01, the proposed occupancy, how you arrived at each of the areas for a total potential occupancy, with a spring-fall occupancy being 588, a grand total being 844. I am looking for clarity on any given month. Are you truly expressing that you will have 844 bodies on the property for the months May, June, July, August, straight through, or 1 month maybe 844, another 600, another 400? What is the planned breakout for the activities of the camp over the course of the season?
We don't have a plan to have 844 there at any time in overnight programs, which is why we came up with that 622 number. So when my understanding, I wasn't there at the beginning when they started this process, Tim could maybe speak to that, but my understanding is that in working with the county said, put everything in that you could possibly want to have in there. You want to do this process again, it's long, it's tedious, it has been. And so they put everything in that we could possibly dream of doing. Some of those things are summer camp programs, where we have a list of here's what we're planning to do, that's where that 622 number comes from. Other housing we would plan to use would be winterized housing retreat center, or winterized housing that we could use in the spring and fall for a weekend retreat, a youth group coming up, or for outdoor education during the week. So that's where you see some of that difference, where the number is 844. If we were using everything at one time, it would be 844, even though there was no plan programmatically to have 844 there at any given time. Does that make sense?
Okay, so it was for a potential maximum impact.
Yes.
Collect data, what that impact would be, and mitigate for that number with an understanding that maximum at any given time would be significantly less, but more likely around the 622 number?
That's the number that we have identified, because 5-7 years ago, we've been having these conversations. We said, so what we were telling our neighbors, well, we don't plan to do that. And they'd say, well, but you could, right? And so we said, okay, well, let's go back and think, what were we planning to do during the summer? That's where we came up with that 622 number. Here's what we would plan to do. Here's what we would like to do. And so that's where we proposed that 622.
So that 622, roughly how many of those individuals are staff volunteers that are staying on site and would not be entering, leaving on a daily basis, etc.?
57 of those would be counselors living in the cabins with the campers. An additional 20 would kind of be volunteers slash guests. And then support staff, using the same percentage that we have now of support staff, we would have 86 of those would be support staff positions, people working in the kitchen, wranglers, maintenance staff, et cetera, et cetera.
So between 150 and 160 would be
yes.
staff.
Okay. Yes.
You've answered my occupancy question that I had for the moment. Mr. Lloyd, did you have something to add?
Just a comment about the chart that you referred to at the very beginning. What's the discrepancy, the difference between the 500 number and 800 number? Part of that is the fact that many of the 844 are not winterized housing. And so when you take those out and you look at what we could potentially do in the off season, that's how we came up with the 500. Because people are not going to sleep in tent structures, platforms, or on the ground in the off-season. So all those beds kind of go away. In the off-season, the numbers are much smaller. That's why that ended up that way.
Okay, and you're using the term off-season.
When the weather's cold, yeah.
So
spring and fall.
Is Kidder Creek's plan to potentially operate 12 months out of the year?
That has never been part of our discussion and is primarily driven by the weather, in that December, January, February are not good weather times to run outdoor activities, which is what Kidder Creek does, primarily run adventure programs. So we would have to develop other programs that didn't require you to be outside. If you notice in the plan, there are no great big amphitheater, enclosed structures, gymnasiums or anything. There isn't really structures designed that way because that wasn't the intent. The intent is really for outdoor activities. And when you get snow on the ground, it's really muddy, which we're at an elevation, you understand this, that the weather's very unpredictable. Nobody wants to be in the mud. So it's very difficult to plan programs around that kind of weather. So we've always thought spring, summer, and fall as much as we could. When the weather's, we can't do outdoor activities, and we probably wouldn't do much.
Are you there now, locally, physically there? Is the camp open for staff only or
now? Well, the problem is we don't have any winterized facilities. And I'm the facility guy, so I can tell you, I close everything down because it would freeze.
Yeah, right.
Our goal is to build some winterized facilities, you know, where people can get inside for housing. But like I said, it's never been the plan to have a big arena or anything activity-wise that's indoors. We just don't do that.
We know cold. I say we know cold around here.
Yeah, that's right.
And did you have something else to add?
No. I was just going to say, we did have our last group about a month ago now, mid-October. Part of the plan is to expand that season. Warm place to sleep makes a big difference. We do want to have people there in the spring and fall to expand that shoulder season, so that is part of the proposal. But like Tim was saying, there's no big indoor space where we're just hanging out all the time, and there is no plan to have, you know, winter programs available at the camp, just for the same reasons that Tim was saying. It's just the weather's unpredictable.
All right, so I'm going to move off occupancy, come back to Haley for a moment. Mm-hmm. Do you have clarification on the earlier question?
Yes, so on the property, APN ID N310, only staff residences are proposed on that parcel. So okay. No other ancillary recreational structures.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Mr. Hart?
Yeah, because I had this all written down back in August when I went over there. I just dug out all these questions. I got a whole pile of stuff here.
Okay. All right. You have a question while I scroll to my next?
No, go right ahead. We'll get to the bottom of this. Yeah.
Okay. My next highlight here. Okay, we took care of that one. That one was covered earlier on. Okay. So, on staff report, some housekeeping, reflecting back on page 8 to our August meeting, the commission's request for additional information. The first one there regarding CDFW for clarification, whether or not an LSA permit is needed. I have this highlighted with the following question, because going through, there are a couple documents where the discussion indicates part of the new pond would be in the quote-unquote Kidder Creek floodplain. There is discussion in a couple other areas where it is mentioned that if that was inaccurate and that the new proposed pond would not be in the Kidder Creek floodplain. And so my question is the FEMA designated floodplain what was originally being referenced and utilized versus what is the realized floodplain? Because I'm very aware that the FEMA line on the map has several of my barns and homes on the ranch within the floodplain of Scott River. And I can tell you, if they flooded, there would be nothing left in this valley. We'd be talking about a 80-foot deep flood, which maybe it'll happen, but if that happens, that's the least of my concerns as a barn.
You talk about your house where you live?
Yeah. My house is...
Well, they don't do topos.
No, I know, and that's why this question, as it regards to the 1600 permit, as I understood it, CDFW was saying it may be needed because it was within the floodplain, and so I wanted clarification on that.
Yeah, so staff double-checked, and it is not within the FEMA floodplain.
Okay. But it is still within what, is it within a floodplain? And if so, who designated it and how?
We didn't see it was located within a floodplain when staff looked at the FEMA floodplain buffer zone area, yeah.
Okay, so the construction of that pond is outside the floodplain, therefore, because it's not disturbing bed bank channel, not within the active floodplain, LSAA likely not needed.
Right.
Okay. That, wanted to confirm that. Okay, that one was addressed earlier. Okay, so I did my homework. I'm going to see if staff did their homework. On number four, confirm if recreation is explicitly spelled out in the Scott River Adjudication Decree. I'll let you answer before I do.
I did not see recreation spelled out in the decree.
Really? Not once under any of the beneficial uses in the Scott River Decree?
Don't believe so, no.
Need to do a word search on the AP4 document. Okay, so it is recognized as a beneficial use.
Okay.
It is noted on two water rights in the Scott River Decree.
Okay.
It is not listed as a beneficial use on Barker Dam. That is not to say that it can't be, but it must be petitioned through the State Water Board to add recreation as a beneficial use. So that's some homework for the project proponents should this pass. The second item I would comment on related to that is if you're going to be going through the process of petitioning to add the beneficial use, I would also add winter groundwater recharge.
Yeah. Was the pond there originally?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but according to the map, you have an existing pond located where the new pond is basically going to incorporate part of that, or no. Is that old no. pond that's...
If you put the map up, you'll see they're two separate.
To the side of the barn.
That's not what I'm asking.
Yep.
What I'm asking, the original pond is there right now. Was that there before they were acquired?
Absolutely. That pond was referenced in a document written in the 1850s.
Okay. So it's got to be part of the original water right there. Part of the court decree. So they don't need to do anything with that. Just because they have...
On that one, correct.
But the new one, that's a whole different deal.
Correct. And that's why I'm saying. So the new one will be the flow through by Barker.
Maybe, maybe not.
Well, no, that's what's in here.
Is all water going into the new pond, then you go back?
Yes.
In a discharge pipe?
No, flow into through to Barker. Ditch. Barker, POD,
right.
Ditch to new pond, at least according to the plan, into the pond, out of the pond, continuing Barker's ditch.
Yes.
It's a flow through
pond. So, and again, I'm not an attorney. I'm just trying to understand the rationale of them having to go back for creating a pond, but there's no consumptive use.
Preparation.
It's just a bigger, wider ditch.
Technically,
I'm asking the question. No. I don't know.
No, I would say that'd be illogical.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, what's the state going to require? I have no idea. And if there's no consumptive use, and you're going down, you're just widening the ditch. What do you need to change in the water right what you're doing there, since it's already been diverted? I don't know. I'm just asking that question.
I make my point simply as the beneficial uses listed in the decree currently for Barker's Ditch is residential, livestock, irrigation.
Okay, so back to the other original pond, water comes down and it flows out into the pastures.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so under the original water right, way back, is there something in the court decree that spells out that pond and the use of that pond? Even though they're using it for recreation now, it wasn't when they were...
Yeah, in the decree, no. In the decree, no. That is a question, though. For for the two existing ponds on the place, are there permits for either of them, and are you paying the state your $500 per year for having a pond on your property like the rest of us are?
That one pond was a mill pond, right? Yes. Originally?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know what that means. But...
I go ahead and come up, because I know reservoirs that were built in the 60s, 50s, 70s have permits through the state. I've got a sump I'm paying $500 a year on, which Murphy has a little that's been dry for 2 years. He pays $500 a year for having that little pond by the house. So the state, no state permits on either of those?
No, and there has been a fair amount of discussion about that. And if you want to go back, as far as the recreational use, that letter that Alan Neely wrote, addressed recreational use in the pond. As far as the license, discussions that I've had with the state is that it's grandfathered in because it's been there for so long.
Well, the one at Murphy's was done in the 1800s, and they're still having to pay the state on it. So
since there's no water master service, don't you have to record what you're diverting and how much, and you annually report?
Yes,
that?
We do.
For the ditch.
For the ditch. So whatever, once it goes down the ditch, it's
right.
It's a moot point. I'm guessing.
I'm just trying to keep them from getting in trouble.
I'm Pandora's box here, and right. Maybe I'm going somewhere where there's no reason to be going anywhere.
Blair, that has been a big part of the conversation, is who has jurisdiction over that and whether they actually have a right to say something about it or not. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to get involved, but at this point, they're leaving it the way it is.
So, staff, when you send this out to the state clearinghouse and it's distributed, does it go to the State Water Resource and Control Board staff?
Yes.
And they had no response
related
about this?
Related to this, no.
Okay. Answer my questions.
Okay. We answered CAL FIRE, answered those questions on that one. Approval 17, okay, we covered that one. I asked the chief about that one. We just covered that. Continuing down the mitigations, here we go. Okay, question for clarification on page 14. Mitigation measure 4.6. Brings up the discussion on jurisdictional waters in the United States, bringing in Army Corps. Looking at the map, I believe, let me reduce this down, let's see here, which of the appendices was this on? Leave. Is it on L? One of the maps that had the discussion about jurisdiction of the Army Corps had an awful lot of blue identifying wetlands. And I have the question, did Army Corps come out and visit the site, first of all?
Yes.
Yes.
And they designated all the wetlands.
Okay. Are you aware whether or not they identified the ditches on the property as wetland, or did they designate it as historical and not grandfathered in? It's a historical structure.
They didn't designate any of the ditches.
Mr. Lloyd, could you please come?
Sorry, they didn't address any of the ditches on the property.
Okay.
They addressed wetlands themselves. Anything that qualified as a wetland under the state definition, they determined.
Okay. I was looking for clarification because sometimes you get one person that looks at it one way, and other times you get somebody else that looks at it differently. So I was looking to see how that map was prepared. You answered my question. Thank you. All right. So that takes care of that question. Come back here. Okay. Floodplain was addressed. Okay. So, I am, Cal Fire addressed that one. CDFW addressed that one.